This talk then will build on the some of the issues that came up in the last presentation. Insect resistance, you know, is talked about very broadly and oftentimes with a considerable lack of precision, and that's to the detriment of many involved, I believe. We know that it's accepted pretty much throughout the entomological community that we're referring to heritable changes in insects that make them less susceptible to insecticides. But really, this doesn't have much value beyond the introductory entomology course. The problem is that when we seek a more precise definition, we really get hung up in a mess, and it's that that I'm trying to address. One extreme view is that resistance, if you're going to claim it's resistance, you have to have a field failure. I would like to weigh in on the fact that I don't think that's very helpful. Obviously, there's issues with credibility when someone's having a field failure somewhere, and you haven't even addressed the issue up to that point because of fear of using the R word. It makes resistance management reactive rather than proactive, and proactivity is a fundamental precept of resistance management. It's an impediment to open and candid discussions about changes in susceptibility of populations, and I'd really like us to be able to discuss these things openly. It's an impediment to research investigations, and really kind of serves as a pushback against the academic community. This is why should I pursue this? And most importantly, as I often quote from the Arizona grower who brought this to my attention, is that we were just no damn good to him most of the time in resistance management, because all we did was postmortems, come in after he's quit using something and tell him why it didn't work. So that's on one extreme. The opposite extreme I've referred to obliquely in the last presentation, and that is if you've got tenfold reduction in susceptibility relative to some baseline somewhere, you got resistance. And I would like to claim that that's equally unconstructive as a standard. That it depends on all sorts of things that I'm sure everyone here knows about, the comparator, the what toxicant are you working with, mortality criterion development, or are you looking at the doornail dead type of criterion. It's arbitrary. It has no real-world foundation, and it's pest-dependent. Are we talking about Zea, where a small change potentially could make a big difference? Are we talking about virescence and pectinophora, as you saw? What's a tenfold change when you've got huge amounts of protein and high susceptibility? And there are great liabilities to defining resistance on the basis of these small changes in the lab. The one that strikes me personally, having stuck my neck out on multiple occasions when we had to put management programs in place, was you lose credibility when you, as I have done, say, look, we've got this huge resistance in pink bollworm. We have to do something about this now. And then I spend the next decade showing that it's of no significance in the field. The other point is it can be result in unnecessary costs, and you know the story. And the biggest point here is that that press release I showed from the University of Arizona goes around the world in 24 hours, and regulators in other parts of the world are then citing these things. And we're talking about technology here that is impacting the environment, human health, and our IPM systems, we hope, in a consistent, positive way, and we can point to that. And so we just, if we are making decisions that are pulling these things out, we want them to be very deliberate. So we have to respond to claims of resistance, whether they're real or perceived. We have to establish triggers, and EPA expects us to have these triggers. That's why I talked about those few survivors and what we do with them, because because this is, you know, it's a regulatory issue as well as a IPM issue. So what are meaningful differences? Well, let me just get empirical for a minute. This is baseline data my lab collected on Cry2AB baselines. Those are data from the Southwest. You can't know what a meaningful difference is if you don't have these kinds of robust baselines. And the issue here is that you're trying to determine what the distribution of variation is. And this is a point that Dr. Luttrell has shown consistently, wide, wide variation in Zaya. Well, here is wide variation in Pectinophora to a protein that it's quite susceptible to. And the point is that you can very easily isolate this, and that's not what we're looking for. What we're looking for is this, okay? Things that are going to be outside of that baseline distribution. This then brings up a few of the points I'm just going to touch on. The purpose of a reference strain is not as a de facto standard. It's an index of whether or not you can do a bioassay reproducibly. And frequently, it's not a meaningful reflection. Baselines are not meaningful reflections of field strains for a number of reasons. They're laboratory adapted, they're highly inbred. And typically what you see is the baselines of those distributions that occur in the field normally, that your lab strains are way over on the susceptible side. And what we're looking for a good comparator, is something here that allows us to lay in some monitoring concentrations that when you get survivors of them, you can take it to the bank that you've got something different. Okay? Any given bioassay then, we know, for those of us that have done this mind-numbing comparison of different methodologies, can vary depending on all the factors. And you can make something look big or you can make something look small depending upon how you tweak the variables in the lab and the nature of the chemical. So what's a meaningful bioassay? Well, there's no recipes, obviously. How well does it reflect the pest encounter with the toxin in the field is the gestalt. That's the beginning point of saying, okay, well, we're trying to come up with something meaningful. And if you've got a whole bunch of toxin in a plant over a long period of time, it's pretty important that you look at a lot of stages because that's what's happening in the field, and that you start with what gets exposed in the field and that you'd be thinking about relative doses. And obviously, the whole spectrum of bioassays that we're talking about already in this meeting, from a two-day adult vial bioassay, typical seven-day assays, which were talked about earlier, a 17-day IGR bioassay, now you're going a very long portion of the white fly's life, or if with our pink bull, and we ran them 21 days. Because when they survived that, we could really say, okay, we got something there. And yet, even when a strain is over tenfold less susceptible than the reference strain and significantly less than any of the baselines, even when you have both of those steps in place, it doesn't mean that it's going to produce viable offspring. And this goes back to the Zaya issues we keep talking about. What are the costs associated with it? And this then brings up the point that resistance in the laboratory does not necessarily reflect it in the field. And many times, they're just two completely different worlds. I'm just going to very quickly touch on a few of these examples that illustrate this. Resistance in the lab does not equal resistance in the field point. This BT pink bollworm I mentioned, what I call laboratory amplified resistance. It was already out there. It jumped out at us in six generations, very high levels of resistance. Fell right off of our radar screen when we're monitoring at 1 in 10. Indeed, there's molecular monitoring that's been done on over 6,000 moths by the Tabashnik lab in the last 6 years, and they haven't detected one cadherin mutation in a moth in the field. Okay, it's very, very low levels. Pyraproxifen's another example, resistance in the lab not equaling the field. Dr. Ellsworth here has done a lot with us on this. Here you see the baselines, the variation in the baselines. We picked that nice high concentration. You see 0.1. Here you see that 0.1 concentration. We went 1, 2, 3 years with no change at 0.1, and then it headed downhill. And by the end of 5 years, it progressed from 99.2 to 74% mortality at that discriminating concentration. And of course, I went to Peter and said, Peter, we're in trouble. He says, you need to do the field work. And he's exactly right. And so, as Peter does so well, large-scale field trials, multiple locations, guess what? We were able to isolate a very high level of resistance. This is resistance developing in the lab. We monitor it through time. It has not impacted field performance, or you can give us the latest update from Arizona, Peter, if you're beginning to see it. But the point is, you have to demonstrate these points, and especially when you're talking about selective chemistry. The natural enemies are resistance managers. And if you're leaving good natural enemies behind, they're cleaning up these populations. Other evidence of mistakes that I've made, you see the red here. I watched a progressive at very high range of concentrations for whitefly in Arizona. I watched that mortality fall from 95 through 98, sounded the alarm, said, we've got to do something. And look what the subsequent 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years. I mean, I think the best way to manage resistance is to go out public and say, this is going to be a problem. And this is what ends up happening. All right, no corresponding loss of field performance, although they are talking now in the Yuma area of seeing some changes. Susceptibility regained, no plausible biological explanation I can come up with. The Zaya point, we've already talked about the retrospective by Tabashnik, the rebuttal, the resistance monitoring failed to detect strains with susceptibility that were outside of the range, and then all the data I've already reflected on Ali and Luttrell, and the sentinel plots, okay? Lab, one thing, field, something very different. So, in summary, what I would like us to do is to be comfortable with the complementary and unique nature of resistance in the lab and resistance in the field, and understand we have to have resistance in the lab measurements. We have to talk about them. They allow us proactivity, isolating mechanisms and responding early. But you do not make decisions on what you're going to do with an IPM program or a resistance management program on that basis. Resistance in the lab helps us with all of these things. Changes to IRM recommendations, though, have to be based on resistance in the field. You have to demonstrate that the resistance has caused or will imminently cause increased generational survival. They're going to be breeding and impacting future generations. This can be evidenced from sentinel efficacy plots, laboratory greenhouse plots employing plants, et cetera. Summary, we need to take this to the next level and insist that we get away from this gibberish of talking about resistance without defining whether it's lab or field, recognizing the strengths of both, and I'd say promoting both within the contexts which are appropriate for them. Thank you.